only signed one of the bills, one of the copies, so...
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. I want to welcome all of you back to the session. And I know that we are very proud that Senator Neville has taken the body of experience that he's gained, in particular in this committee, with Senator Betzold and others. And now he has moved on to the bright side of the light, to bigger and better things. So we've added a... well, you know, judges would almost think that that's really what it is, if you were a judge. So we're very... we wish Senator Neville well. He's been a thoughtful contributing member to this committee, and I personally will miss him and his contribution. That being said, we have a new member in the committee who is not here. I'm sure she'll come in later. Senator Pat Parasol has been added to the committee. Senator Betzold?
Madam Chair, actually, I saw Judge Neville about 2 weeks ago and asked him, say, Judge, how's it going, and like that. And he said, you know, when the judges all came to us and told us about these, you know, how we're overworked and lack of resources, it's true. And he told me that in a 3-day period he had to process 75 cases, that he was handed a stack of documents this high and said, this is for the case you got in 5 minutes. And he had to go on the bench and call the attorneys in and said, look, I don't know anything about the case. You're going to have to guide me through this one. He went to his very first judges meeting, and they've got a budget shortfall because they're spending a lot of money on interpreters and psychologists and so forth, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with it. So he may be up here asking us for some help. But
I have an interpreter bill.
Maybe we'll have Judge Neville come and testify in some of the bills that will be before the committee. But I just want to recognize the fact that he's not here, but we have a new member. And I want to thank all of you for coming today. We have one confirmation on the agenda today, and then we're going to be hearing back from some reports that we compelled people to do a lot of work over the summer. And so we want to hear back because it's going to help guide us in what we're going to do. And I know this always happens because we'll go and then once the committee comes in and everybody wants to rush out of here as they appropriately should. So I just want to let all of you know that this is a light week. We won't have a meeting tomorrow. But as a forewarning to all the members and staff, that next week we'll be double shifting. So we will have an afternoon meeting. And then we will have an evening meeting both on Tuesday and Thursday. And on Tuesday evening in particular, we're going to be looking at the Victims Compensation Fund bill. So please put those time slots on your calendar and so that we can have a quorum and have the full complement of our committee members here.
Madam Chair, on that point, what time do you anticipate the evening meetings to start?
Six thirty. And I hope that we don't, particularly on Tuesday, because we only have one bill. I hope that we don't go, you know, any more beyond 8:30 at the latest. But I can't promise you on Thursday. We might lead to about 9 o'clock on Thursday evening. I don't have all the bills in front of me, but it's just processing. I mean, it's just processing and. I know that you all will appreciate this, including staff, is that I'd rather we start a little bit early with this double shifting instead of doing, you know, triple shifting or meeting every day. And I'm really trying to avoid Friday meetings just because I know that it's going to be a really hard week for everyone with everybody trying to do evening meetings and afternoon meetings. And I know other committees have started their evening meetings on the first day of session, so... I feel like we're in deadline week, and I apologize if we have to do that, but we need to get the work done. So let the record reflect that we do have a quorum, and I want to welcome to the committee Mr. John Hopeman. He has been appointed to the Board on Judicial Standards, and so I would invite Mr. Hopeman, please. I believe that the governor's letter of appointment is in your folder. You can look at that. Look at Mr. Holtman's application. And you are welcome to give us some thoughts or comments or make a statement.
Thank you, Senator Moi, and the other members of this honorable committee. I'm John Hopeman. I grew up in the United States Army. My father was a career Army officer. I lived all over the world. I came up here to go to college in 1963. And since then, except for 2 years, I've lived in Minnesota my whole adult life. I live in South Minneapolis now. I'm married to Jane Hopeman, who is a law librarian at William Mitchell Law School in St. Paul. I have three adult children. I was educated at the University of Minnesota Law School. I taught there for 7 years full-time, and I still teach there part-time. While I was teaching there full-time, I ran their civil clinical program representing indigent people who could not afford representation in the courts, in family law cases, consumer cases, juvenile court, and that sort of thing. We used that as a vehicle not only to provide public services, but to educate the students who would, under my supervision, represent these people. I then went to the U.S. Attorney's Office, where I served for 11 years as a federal prosecutor. I began under James Rosenbaum, who was the U.S. attorney who hired me, and I worked for Jerry Arnold, and then I worked for David Lillehaug. And then 14 years ago, I left and I went into private practice, and now I appear mostly in federal court. I defend white-collar criminal cases. I also do compliance investigations for companies. I've been on the board on judicial standards for about a year now, and I've attended all the meetings. It's been very interesting. The board primarily addresses complaints that are filed by citizens and lawyers and other judges against sitting judges. I found that most of the complaints have no merit, but a few do have merit, and what the board does is decide upon a recommended discipline and recommend the discipline to the Supreme Court, and then if the judge contests it, a hearing is held, and the board hires a lawyer to represent the board at that hearing. I don't consider myself to represent any constituency on that board except the public interest, and from what I've observed, the other members of the board seem to be of the same mind, be they lawyers, private citizens, or judges. I think it's an important public service. I think the public needs to feel that if a judge has misconducted him or herself, that there ought to be a place that they can go to make a complaint that will be addressed. I have enjoyed this duty. It's an important public service, I think, and I request your confirmation so that I may continue in this appointment. Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't think Mr. Holtman might remember this, but I did have a case when you were at the University of Minnesota where I represented a client and you had a client through the unit. But then you left and then Mr. Beffert replaced you, so I didn't really get to work with you very much.
Yes, sir. I do not remember the case.
No, I mean, you handled many of them, of course. And it was quite a long time ago, of course. But as I say, you were only there for a short period of time that I was involved. But I do want to make a comment or two, mainly about the board here, because I've been on this committee for 16 years, and it's always been difficult to ask applicants questions simply because, and I'm aware of the nature of the board. I mean, sometimes you look at complaints against judges where the judges don't even know that there's a complaint. Sometimes they aren't told about that because, and this may be dismissed or whatever, but a lot of things that are done are not necessarily brought to the public's attention unless there's some sort of an appeal process, unless it goes, becomes a public record. Most things do not. So it becomes very difficult to ask members of the board about specifics because they generally aren't able to talk about it. The concern that I do have, Madam Chair, Mr. Holtman, that I'll hope you take back to the board, is that I've gotten a much better insight of the board's operations through the last couple of months because I serve on a Supreme Court advisory committee that's been looking at the judicial rules, and we've been having a lot of meetings doing this. And I've learned far more about the board. In particular, I'm concerned about the executive director's role and what the executive director provides to the board members and what you act upon. We discovered that, for instance, he was not expunging records as every 3 years as the rules required him to. Now, his explanation was that, well, my small staff is just me and my secretary. We don't have the resource time to do it. But he's also said, if I had my way, we wouldn't destroy any records, even the unsubstantiated claims, apparently. Judges that I've talked to some judges who said we just don't trust him for advice. Everything seems to be right or wrong, and some judges are concerned that he might be vindictive because he can initiate complaints against judges, I think, if they go too far. So I'm and this advisory board did try to have access to the records to find out the complaint process. He fought us tooth and nail saying, well, I've promised confidentiality to the complainants, and therefore I don't think we should open them up. Well, he had no legal basis to do that. So I hope that you and the other board members do look very closely at what's going on with that board, and you should see what's going on with the records. You should know if they're following their own rules of expungement and what advice he is giving to judges, because, as I say, I've made it clear, I do not trust the executive director of the board. I think we've got outstanding members that serve on the board, but you only get the information that this person feeds you. I don't expect a response here, but I'm just telling you what my concerns are, and I hope that you operate independently and use your best judgment along the way when you're a member of the board. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments to Mr. Hochman? Very good. See none. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'll move whatever the motion is to
recommend confirmation.
Senator Higgins moves that this committee recommend that the appointment of John Hochman as an attorney member of the Board on Judicial Standards be confirmed. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. We're going to hear or get a report and recommendation on the 2007 Collateral Sanctions Committee. Judge Isabel Gomez, who is, as you all know, the executive director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, led the work of the Collateral Sanctions Committee this summer. And she's here to give us her report. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. It's good to be here this afternoon. I am Isabel Gomez, and I have with me one of the Commission's researchers, Jacqueline Krause, who was the staffer who primarily worked with me on this committee and who helped very much in preparing the report. We also have one member of the committee here with us this afternoon, and that's Todd Liljenquist from the Minnesota Multi-Housing Authority. As you probably know, the committee was created by the 2007 legislature, and I should say that it was our impression that at the time the committee was created, the legislature was particularly concerned with reentry, and so we really rather expected that our focus was going to be on people with significant criminal records. In 1990, Minnesota had about 8,800 felonies, and in 2006, we had 16,400. And, of course, a corollary of that is an awful lot of people who go to prison are getting out of prison every year. The Department of Corrections can tell that there are 7,700 exits from prison, or there were in 2006. That's not 7,700 people, because some people go in and out more than once. But it suggests the magnitude of concerns that we might have about, and appropriately do have, about preventing recidivism among those folks once they enter the community. At all times, I want to make it clear that all of the recommendations of the committee are framed in terms of public safety. What we learned that was a revelation to some of us was that there are really many more people without significant criminal records, and indeed people who you might think no likelier to commit any offense than the next person, who are being very seriously impacted by any record of a brush with the police or the criminal justice system. And when we're talking about those folks, we're not talking about public safety. When we're talking about them, we're really talking about what is fair and what is just. Those cases are very, very interesting. I mean, what we find are people who are prevented from getting jobs because of arrest, because of charges that were dismissed, despite acquittals, because of outgrown misdemeanors, misdemeanors that were vacated and dismissed, and so on. And one measure of the magnitude of that is, I've indicated there are 16,000-plus felony convictions every year. There are 163,000 non-traffic misdemeanors every year. And so if we're going to start treating people with those kinds of records in a very negative light, the impact is tremendous. And the report has lots of stories of people sort of scattered through it. I'm only going to tell one, and the one I'm going to tell, I'm telling because it's one of these folks, and the story really sums up a lot of the issues that we encountered in studying this area. I have a friend whose youngest son had quite a lot of conflict with his parents as a teenager because he was using alcohol. When he graduated from high school, he immediately moved out of the house and set up his own apartment. He had a job. He was working. And sometime between the age of 18 and 20, sometime between the ages of 18 and 20, he got into a bar fight and was charged with assault. Obviously, he was not about to tell his parents that he was in a bar fight since he wasn't even supposed to be in the bar. And he was not eligible for a public defender because he was working and paying his bills. And so he went to court, and he was charged with assault, and he pled guilty to assault. If he had gone there with a lawyer, there's no way he would have pled guilty to assault. Probably he would have pled guilty to use of alcohol by a minor or some other less damaging charge. On a second occasion, again, in those 2 years, he wrote a worthless check from his own account for $38 and something. He went to court with the $38 and, again, since he did it, pled guilty. And so he has 2 misdemeanors on his record. He is now 27. When he was 20, his girlfriend became pregnant, and he became a dad. And from the time that baby was anywhere in the offing, Tom has never done anything irresponsible that I'm aware of. He certainly has never been arrested. And, in fact, he's been his little boy's primary parent. He's been the parent who raised Ethan, who went to kindergarten this year. And Tom recognized that it was time for him to get more education in order to increase his income. So he got a loan, went to Brown Institute, took a course, and then applied for work. He did well in the course, applied for work last May. He was offered job 3 times. 3 times the job was withdrawn because of those misdemeanors. Mind you, things that he did when he was really a kid. And having shown 7 years or more of absolutely law-abiding and perfectly upright conduct. The third employer told him that if he could get rid of the 2 misdemeanors, that they'd keep the job open because they hoped to hire him. He was not able to do that because assault is a targeted misdemeanor. BCA opposes sealing of those cases, and so that's it. He now has that job would have paid him $30,000 more than he is now earning. Now he has a loan, etc. And there are lots and lots and lots of times. And so when you think about the recommendations of this committee, I hope you'll bear that in mind. So we have this tension also, which might not have been so clear to some of us when we started the work, between the notion that it's desirable to seal criminal records that do not accurately convey a person's character for one reason or another, and the fact that in the 21st century there is a clear and growing public interest in having full access to information about people when we're making important decisions, such as who to hire, whom to hire, I guess. So there really is a clear, increasing, and reasonable demand for information. And so there's a tension there. It is, I think, in a society that is dominated by First Amendment principles, peculiar anyway, to argue strenuously for secrecy. But the fact is that even if somehow one believes that the solution to some of these issues is to seal everything in sight, it's not going to work. It simply is not viable, and it's not going to work because there are many private entrepreneurial data miners who are not bound by government rules. And all kinds of information is out there in the Internet, as you can find out if you just go home and turn on your computer. There's a site that will give you, you can look up anybody you want for $9.95. The problem is, of course, those data miners do not use fingerprints. They are totally unregulated. There is no sanction for getting it wrong. And in a state that has three Justices Anderson, we might well be concerned about about people losing opportunities to work because of a $9.95 check. But the point is, we need, this is a big set of issues. It's really multifaceted. And the commission committee came to the view that we need a lot of approaches. Sealing and the appropriate handling of government records is very important. But it's not enough, and we have tried in our recommendations to come up with lots of approaches from various angles. And we're just going to quickly go through those because you have the report in front of you, and I'm not going to read them all. You will be happy to know. The beginning of the report sets out general policy concerning these issues. That policy really informed our discussion, and I hope that you'll take a look at that. But I'm not going to go over it today because they aren't recommendations, and it would take a while to do that. Let's go to
Madam
the notice
Chair,
slide.
Madam Chair, we've got three different sets of papers, Judge Gomez. Which one are you working on?
I'm working on recommendations of the 2007 Collateral Sanctions Committee that is just a set of slides with little, yeah. And you can also see the recommendations at the front of the full report if you want to look at them there.
Senator Foley, I believe that the full report is this, is the criminal records and employment in Minnesota. And then this is the slide. So does everybody have the full report and the slides? Very good. Thank you for asking that question, Senator Foley.
Yes, thank you, Senator Foley. One of the areas that really shouldn't be hard to make significant improvements in is the whole area of notice. What we discovered was that people just don't know about these issues at all. I mean, really at all. And there are some particularly interesting or important places where people need to know. One is the courts. There's a whole discussion in the report about all of these, and so I'm not going to go into the background. But it should be told to people who are in court that pleading guilty or being in court at all may impact their future in a number of ways. And the report gives a sample notice that might be used in that setting. It was very, very interesting to find out that schools who do vocational training and colleges, schools, both high schools and schools of higher education, have never advised their students concerning these matters. So Jacqueline contacted MinSCU, and they were horrified to think that they might have been, or that they had been, allowing and encouraging people to enroll in studies leading to a particular vocation, which they were not going to be able to do because of their prior records. They're very interested. They were very, I think they have reacted really appropriately. I know that they're going to put notice, you know, they're going to take this up and make sure that their handbooks, their freshman orientations, and so on, talk about this reality. There's also a sample notice of that kind. It might be used by educators. I'm very concerned about, particularly about private, for-profit vocational schools. There is, they are supervised. We were told that by the person who's in charge of them that he believes that they are telling people these things. I don't believe they are, and not because they're evil, although they certainly have a profit motive in making sure that everybody who's interested takes a course, but because I doubt they know. It seems to me that if MinSCU is not knowledgeable about these matters and taking care of students this way, it doesn't seem all that likely to me that the private schools are. So going on to the next one. There should, at some point, we should, we've done step one in Minnesota by putting all the collateral sanctions that are statutory in one chapter. What needs to be created is a sort of handbook, it could be on the internet, that would allow, that would be a directory of all of the professions that require state licensure or require clearance from agencies like DHS and the Department of Health, that would tell people what the bar, what the law is, and what the bars are, you know, the kinds of convictions and histories that will prevent them from entering certain vocations. The directory should just give general information about how do you apply, where do you apply, what's the process, and what's going to keep you out. And there ought to be just more public education about this. I remember a campaign that I think the United Way did, or maybe a consortium of nonprofits, about some issue related to the community welfare. It might be possible to make some kind of consortium of that kind just to raise awareness through, you know, billboards or spots on TV or whatever it is, that people need to be thinking about what an arrest or an appearance in court, what impact that might have on their future plans. We talked a lot about the fact that we do have a tremendous number of convictions in the state and that we might want to start thinking about reducing the number of convictions. First of all, there are lots of statutes, 609.135, the stay of imposition statute, 152.18, which has provided the possibility of drug offenders not being convicted, and so on. There, we have a lot of those laws, and they used to be really effective. They're not very effective anymore. And as a former judge, I was shocked because to find this out, because I've been telling people for years that I was doing them a big favor by giving them a stay of imposition or whatever. It didn't make any difference whatsoever, it turns out. And so we might want to look at those laws and modernize them in terms of what we now know is true about the information that's out there and how it's being used. A big problem about those 152.18, for example, the drug set aside, if you will, is equal access. Places that have drug courts, places that have rehabilitation programs available, in those places, judges are likely to give defendants the opportunity to have a clear record by becoming sober and law-abiding. But if you're in a part of Minnesota where you put a person like that on probation and there's nothing you're going to be able to do for him, then probably you're going to impose the guideline sentence and send him to prison. And if you look across the state, you can see some very troubling disparities about who gets an opportunity for these things and who doesn't. Judges are very concerned about this. Lawyers are concerned about it. And so, one, we need to look at the possibility of mandatory statewide application of these laws. I know that Representative Paymar, in his reentry bill, is proposing that 152.18 be mandatory, or that it be applied across the board unless the judge specifically finds that it should not be in a particular case. It would be possible in the 21st century, because we can do such really good prediction of risk with actuarial instruments, it would be possible to institute a statewide diversion program for felonies. And that is kind of a detailed proposition, which is explained somewhat in the text. But again, anything that's done, a big improvement would be to make any statute or to think about the possibility of making these statutes that are supposed to give people who we don't think need to have criminal records a break, to make them mandatory or to make them statewide in some way so that we don't have this disparity of their application. Senator Foley?
Madam Chair and Judge Gomez, when you're looking at all of these things, I venture to say that most judges don't even know all of the sanctions that occur.
You are so right, Madam Chair, Senator Foley. I was just very upset, frankly, when we got into this material, and I thought about all the years in which I told juveniles that they were only delinquent and it wasn't going to matter later. And I told people who had cases continued for dismissal that because they would never entered any plea of guilty, that if they were successful, they were blah, blah, blah. It's not true. And judges don't know this. And so that there is in the section about notice, there's more discussion about things that, you know, might be done within the court system. But yeah, I think we all need to step up our understanding, and it's a huge part of this, I think.
Madam Chair,
Senator Foley,
Senator Gomez, when you look at where we are and the number of offenses, and my understanding of the issue on data privacy is that the district courts, for instance, have a sealed record, or it's not a private record, or and then later on it becomes open, so person can get that. The problem that I've noticed in the law enforcement area is that the everybody seems to have different sets of records, and now
that's
with
right.
The computer systems, that we're in a situation where a significant number of people have things that go back to the public. If you know, for instance, that you're not going to be able to get housing, you're not going to be able to work in a nursing home or a school, or you're in charge of a secure an apartment complex, and so you no longer can be in there. Ken Bacchus, our Senate counsel, and I worked on that, and I'm thankful for what you've done with that. I'm hoping that we can look at what data is where and who should have access to it, and to make certain that the wrong people, with the consequences being what they are, why it's too dangerous to have that information floating around.
That is really very insightful, Senator Foley, and it I couldn't agree with you more. And it part of it, and you will hear more when you hear the sealing recommendations. That group has done a lot of thinking about formatting government background checks and reports. I think, or the committee, one of the things the committee recognized was that those reports should be uniform. They should be clear. They should be accurate. To the extent they use terms like continuance for dismissal or whatever, there ought to be a glossary in them so that people know what that means. And I believe the ceiling group has come up with a couple of different levels, mm-hmm. you know, where you might have more information in some cases than another. When we sent a questionnaire to the licensing agencies, of which there are a crazy number in Minnesota, we found really troubling differences in the amount of information that agencies are getting. I mean, some agencies that you wish would do background checks don't, and only get notice of convictions if the subject happens to mention them. Others who you can't see why they would care so much are banning all felons, which is against the law, and so on and so forth. There needs to be, first of all, the licensing, state licensing agencies should have the right to clear, accurate background checks at a level, you know, including as much information as the legislature deems appropriate for different levels. And again, I think the ceiling folks have done a lot of thinking about that. People ought to be able to get that information. They shouldn't have to rely on their subjects. They should not have to rely on their neighbors or chance or whatever. So I completely agree with you about that. And I think that was the licensing background checks. The next slide, I can skip that one. Licensing, of course, is a very complicated area. And we humbly admit that we just scratched the surface there. We would, as a matter of policy, recommend the elimination of absolute permanent bars. And there's a lot of discussion about that in the report. In the DHS report, which should have been done by now, and I apologize that it wasn't, it will be distributed next week, we do say that DHS ought to be able permanently to bar homicide offenders and sex offenders, not for various reasons, which we explain. But generally, we want to cut down the number of permanent bars. One or two of the licensing agencies that are subject to them said they wish they didn't have them, and that they wish that there was either discretion or a short look-back period to keep people out, to bar them for 5 years or something, but not forever. Mm-hmm. So we also recommend in the report, and that's the next slide, that the agencies, the licensing agencies, have uniform standards for evaluating criminal records. Because one of the things that was really startling in the answers to the questionnaires, when we asked people, what standard do you use? When you look at a conviction, what do you think about in terms of whether you're going to clear that person or not? Everything but the kitchen sink. There is a statute that was written in 1970, Minnesota Statute 364, that ought to have taken care of that. It has not. Many of the agencies don't even know it exists, apparently. So our recommendations do include a modern version of factors that every licensing agency and clearance authority ought to go through and consider when they are making these determinations. Then we'll go to the Minnesota 364. I referenced earlier the so-called data miners, the folks, the entrepreneurs who mine the internet and government records and so on to produce reports, which are important to a lot of people, actually. I mean, some of them are just plain stupid, but others of them are really useful and important, although, you know, we certainly want to get the quality up. Those data miners need to be regulated. At this point, there's absolutely no liability for slandering somebody, for getting the wrong person, the wrong John Anderson, and telling a prospective employer that he has a record that he doesn't have. There's no problem about that. There's no problem if they are informed that they have the wrong person and they don't decide to change the record in the future, et cetera. So we discussed that whole subject, and there is a proposed statute. I want to say right away that there should be a lot of discussion before that statute goes forward, because it's a very important area to a lot of people. Todd would certainly want me to make the point that landlords who are going to lose their real estate or their renter, their license to rent their property if they put criminals in their property, certainly have a right to have relatively reasonable, you know, speedy access to background checks. So it's not necessarily an easy topic, but I think there are parts of it that really can't be argued with. Like if you totally mess it up, you should expect to be sued, you know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
And to remind the committee, we had a bill last year, a judge, that actually dealt with data harvesters, and it passed out of this committee. We had an extensive discussion on it and got to the floor. However, after it passed out of the committee, Ms. Pontius, our Senate counsel, was doing some research and discovered the conflicts with the Federal Credit Reporting Act. And we hadn't quite addressed those in the bill. And although she prepared an amendment for me on the floor, I was uncomfortable trying to deal with that kind of a substantive change on the floor. So I moved to have the bill sent back to this committee, and this was after deadline already. So the bill is back here in committee, and at some point I hope we can revisit last year's bill with the federal law in mind. But we have already kind of ventured into that area.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, frankly, I'll admit I didn't know that because I probably wasn't even thinking about that last year. But it's great that you are. The proposed statute that we have takes a lot from a California statute, which is does not conflict with the federal statute. We think it doesn't, but you're right. It's not an easy matter. It is pretty technical. Because of the data miners and the ubiquity of information that's out there, it seemed to us it really, really important that it ought to be possible for people, everybody, to be looking at the same information, the full information, and for people, for there to be a decision that that person, knowing the whole, when you know the whole catastrophe, is in fact qualified to do X, Y, or Z. And so we thought about various certificates of relief, which I say trump the data miners, because they're saying, okay, so here's the information. Now what? And there is a proposed certificate of good conduct process represented. That's in the House reentry bill as well, or a version of it. The idea is that that for things that are not sealed or everybody knows, you don't go into court asking for sealing. You go into court, I mean, you might, because I think we should have both remedies. But you could go into court, the process is laid out, the qualifications, the notices of who has to get the notice, et cetera, and have a judge review the record and hear from interested parties and review what it is the candidate wants to do with herself and make a decision about whether it is appropriate for that candidate to be able to engage in a particular occupation or whatever. The certificate is intended to overcome any statutory collateral sanctions. That is, it's supposed to allow a person entry to whatever the court has decided the person has shown that she should have entry to. And the really, really important part of it is that it provides some relief from liability for employers because it says if you hire a person who has a certificate of good conduct, you cannot be sued in the future for anything that is in that report. That is, if you knew that he had a theft and now he steals again when he's working for you, you can't be sued because of that prior theft. There obviously still would be liability for negligent hiring and so on, but the idea would be that at least the certificate would provide a little sanctuary in that to some scope of that.
Senator Ortman, did you have a question at this point?
Madam Chair and Judge Gomez, it's always good to see you. A question I have about these certificates of rehabilitation, or I'm not sure what you called it, but the certificate program. If I'm an employer and I've got two candidates, one with a felony background and a certificate, and one without, I might be inclined to hire the person without, and this certificate doesn't really help the person who has it.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, you're absolutely correct. And one of the reasons, you know, government can't cure everything. And also, I want to keep coming back to the committee's view that there ought to be a lot of arrows in the quiver, if you will, because there are a lot of issues. And it's a and so there isn't going to be anything, any one thing that is a fix. There's just no doubt about what you said is true. And so I'm not suggesting that the certificate's going to cure everything. When I think of that young man that I described at the beginning, though, I mean, that would help him out. That was all that employer wanted, was somebody to say, I won't be sued ever because of this 7-year-old misdemeanor, these two 7- or 8-year-old misdemeanors.
Senator Ullman.
Going to require willing employers to make that a successful program. And one of the other concerns that I have about this, I agree with you that we may need more remedy than just one, that maybe there are several options that should be available here. But the maintaining of this system is also a problem. You could have a certificate that should be revoked, and the person may still have a certificate. You know, so how are we going to monitor these certificates? Are we going to have... Are they going to be online now, whether the certificates are still in good standing or not in good standing? And are we looking at certificates among multiple jurisdictions? The expungement bill that I worked on would have required somebody who was looking for expungement to go to each district where there was a conviction, and I'm guessing the same thing is true here, that if you've got a conviction in Ramsey County and Hennepin County, you're looking for a certificate from both because both records are in your past.
That's right.
Have you looked at any of the cost of the recommendations that you've made? Because from what I've understood, they're considerable. And I wonder if the certificate program looks to you to be any less expensive than authorizing the judges to do expungements.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, we did not look at the cost of these. I would think that they'd be pretty similar, actually. And I must say that as a former judge, I would have liked to be able to do either one of the above. And I can't see why this one would cost more than the other one. That's all I can say about it. And I know that perhaps the background, the ceiling folks have got fiscal notes. We didn't have an opportunity to do that, partly because we had no idea what anybody would be interested in anyway. But all of those things do need to be considered, certainly. And you referenced, Senator Ortman, the importance of employers here. One of the things that we felt was a real drawback of the work we did was that we did not have employers represented. We did not have unions represented. And one of our recommendations, we did talk with those folks, you know, somebody occasionally, especially with the union people, because when it came to these work experience things. There ought to be, again, we're talking about education, notice, involvement, all that. Obviously, we have to involve employers. And we also should be involving unions because, the next thing I was going to talk about here was our recommendation that people who are being supervised either by community corrections or in prison should be getting, as far as possible, actual work experience at work that we know is valuable because there's a link between whatever that work is and the community. The unions, in a number of programs that DOC has, as well as a very impressive program in Hennepin County, have been very interested in this. They have a shortage of prospective apprentices. They are not getting as many people as they need. Some unions, I mean, you know, different unions vary. I particularly have talked about people in the building trades. They need more apprentices. They need high-quality apprentices. People in corrections present are high-quality apprentices because they're really supervised, and they really have an incentive because the choice is you go out and work on the house or you sit in a cell. And, you know, these people show up on time, so on and so forth. The unions that have participated in these kinds of programs have been very pleased with the quality of the workers that they've been able to build from convicted people. And when people leave custody or supervision, they, in those union-based programs, are being employed at very high ratios at very good jobs. And the Hennepin program's recidivism statistics are just stunning. Like, recidivism is not a big surprise. Recidivism is not even a factor. If you have a job that pays you $15 or $20 or $25 or $30 an hour. So that possibility is really exciting, particularly, and I know about the budget thing, so I'm not, you know. But if the state were ever to decide that you wanted a public works program to work with, certainly if that were ever to happen, convicted people ought to be part of that project. For one thing, you think about things, the union's been interested in things that the market is not going to build. Low-income housing, senior housing, halfway housing, the rehabbing of all of those boarded-up houses in Senator Higgins' neighborhood and in my Minneapolis, a lot of things that the private market might not be up for, that really where we might be able to make a really good link between reducing recidivism, public safety, and the public good in the other way, so that we're getting more bang for our corrections buck in particular. But that's kind of a dream of mine, but I am the last person in the world to work out the nuts and bolts, so I must admit. We've talked about employers and unions. That liability thing needs to be discussed with employers and everybody a lot. Like, how do we make it less scary for employers to take a chance on someone with a record? You're probably aware that there are two financial incentives for employers that are federally, that were set up by the feds. One is a tax credit program, and the other is a federal bonding service. We were unable, really, to figure out working with Deed. They really haven't. It's been hard to figure out what impact the tax credit program has in Minnesota. What's for sure is it has more effect than the bonding program. The bonding program is completely pointless. They have fewer than 10 bonds being given to employers in a given year. It's just ridiculous. So that needs to be looked at. I mean, either we need to stop pretending we have a bonding program or a tax credit program, or we have to sell it and make it work, because it seems really reasonable. The feds certainly thought it was. And it just is really underutilized, and the bonding service is not utilized at all, for all extents and purposes. We looked at the last little tail here is driver licensing. We talked an awful lot about driver's licenses because they're awfully important to Minnesotans who want to get to work. And so we're inviting you to put together a task force to figure out how to keep more people licensed.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Judge Gomez, just because you raised that issue, I just would share a conversation I just had with a judge up in Beltrami County who was telling me what a problem it was since the legislature added, I think it was, he said, like $650 now to get your license reinstated after some type of a DWI offense. He said what's happened in our area is that we just have more and more people who are driving without licenses, and that means they have no insurance because they have to have a license to get insurance. So we have a growing segment of population driving without car insurance, which has collateral consequences, you know, when people get in accidents too. So,
Senator Higgins.
In addition, we also have quite a few traffic violations for which you can lose your driver's license, and then the same thing happens.
Well, I think that a bill was introduced today that will give us an opportunity to talk about those fees. So the committee will have an opportunity to talk about that.
Just to finish up, Madam Chair, the specific recommendations that we did make concerning driver's licenses are, first, that judges be allowed to more discretion about what they report to DPS, and that they be allowed not to report non-driving violations, which will trigger another loss of license. And there's a whole that's explained in there. But when in the dinosaurs roamed the earth and I started in this business, judges used to be able to make a determination case by case. Is the commissioner going to know about this or not? Which was essentially a decision, should you lose your license again or not? And, you know, judges are given discretion about much more bigger things than that. And it was too bad that they lost their discretion about reporting license violations and insurance violations particularly. Also, there are a couple of weird little laws where people lose their driver's licenses for things that are not to do with driving. For example, if you steal gasoline, you get your license suspended. Well, we all know that the gas stations have figured out how to keep us from doing that. And there's no reason why gasoline is more precious than bumpers, tires, stuff in it. It doesn't make any sense to say you can't drive if you're a thief. The twain does not necessarily meet, so we would suggest a repeal there. There's another statute that says that if you use a driver's license or any other ID to buy alcohol or tobacco, you will lose your license. Now, our thought was, if you misuse your driver's license that way, seems to me the state's entitled to say, if you're going to be abusing your driver's license, then you're just not going to have one for a while. I mean, you know, that argument could be made. But it's really hard to see why, if you use your student ID or somebody's student ID, the same thing should be true. And also, the tobacco part is really hard to I find it hard to find to make an argument why that should happen. So that's all I have to say on the subject, Senator Moy.
Judge Gomez, on behalf of the Senate and the various committees that came together to ask you to take on this task, I want to say thank you to you and all the various members of the committee who worked very hard all through the interim to put these recommendations together. I have had a chance to look through the report, and I believe that you all have been very thoughtful. I appreciate the approach that there is not a single solution, but we do need multiple arrows in the quiver. And so I do appreciate the thoughtful approach and giving us some recommendations that hopefully will spark some conversations to help address some of the concerns that we all have. So thank you very much to you and to the committee members. Senator Foley.
Are you going to continue on with something else now? Is that your intention? Is Judge Gomez going to be available, or some of these other folks that we have here?
Senator Foley, Judge Gomez is going to be available. She did the presentation. We're going to spend maybe the next 5-10 minutes or whatever is of interest to the committee members to discuss or to ask questions, if you would like to ask questions about the report. Today, my intention is to have the two groups give us their recommendations on these reports. I've had people in the public ask whether or not they could testify on these issues, but I feel that it is more productive for public testimony from, you know, different participants who might have other opinions on the specific recommendations if and when we actually have a bill before us that addresses each of those recommendations, that it would be more productive because then we have something concrete to work with, and that, you know, people's testimonies or points, testimonies would then be more more on point and could help us shape whatever language we have in front of us. So today it's my intention that we have an opportunity to ask questions, to get clarifications on the recommendations. And so I have asked that members of the public, if they would like, they're more than welcome to submit comments to us on the information they hear today. We will make it part of the record and make sure it gets to members of the committee. But it is not my intention to take testimony from anyone in the audience other than from the judge. So, you know, we have the next 5-10 minutes for members of the committee to ask questions or to clarify any information that's in the report. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would hope that we would be in a position to at least look at who's here and that. I've been on the task force for criminal and juvenile justice, and there's a number of members here in that, and we've been looking at data privacy and the things that are brought on by these collateral sanctions that are occurring, and I would hate to lose the information. I would certainly want Judge Gomez to explain what's gone on that creates a problem with individuals and the data privacy legislation, and I know here that. That the folks that we have are here. None of us that I know of had copies of the report. So there's a time gap there that maybe you take whatever length of things you want now, but plan for another hearing at a later date to provide more information to get us where. We should be the what's there in the data area is all of this, like the data miners and stuff, and what we're going to do with those, what we're going to do with the expungement and those kinds of things. So I just want you to know that I'm very interested in doing that. If need be, I'll have my own committee look at it. But.
Absolutely. Senator Foley, our intention is that these, again, the committee members have worked very hard. In the interest of time, I just want to receive the report back from the two committees. Henceforth, I mean, it's, you know, I know that this is an area that's of interest to members on this committee, and I know it's of interest to me, so we will have opportunities to discuss these issues, whether it's in, you know, different pieces of the bills or if there are a particular area that we feel that we need to bring the judge back and other participants who are doing work in other areas back to give us information, I would be more than glad to try to accommodate that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, I have the reentry working group's bill, and it includes a fair number of these proposals. I've got the tax credit bill. I've got some other bills. And so if Senator Moi will give us hearings on those, we'll be having a lot of discussions on at least some of these pieces. I know Senator Betzel said he had the data miners that we'll get back to. And, you know, this is some great work that was done, and it kind of gives us a roadmap of some really good things that we could do to help out some good folks, or some folks who will be good now that they're out trying to make a better life. So,
is there any other questions for Senator for Judge Gomez? You keep getting demoted today, Judge Gomez, to being a senator. So very good. Well, Judge, thank you.
Thank you,
and again, thank you, committee members, for the wonderful work that you've done.
It's our pleasure.
We will now pick up the report from the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group, and they're going to give us their report and recommendations on background checks and the sealing of criminal records. And while they're setting up, I just want to share with the members of this committee that, last week, Senator Scheid, Senator Rest, and I, and we invited all of you, by the way, to participate in the Northern Border Security Tour that we went on. And one of the issues that really is hitting our border communities, as well as is really becoming a barrier for a lot of our merchant marine and our people who work in our ships and in our transportation system, is the whole background checks issue and being able to go from the United States to Canada not being barred. Particularly, one example that was brought up time and again is the difference in how Canada and the United States treat DUIs. And so you could have a 25-year-old DUI conviction in the United States, and you might not be able to do your job because it entails that you go into Canada. So, you know, our truckers, our truck drivers, our rail workers, our people who work in our shipping industry, I mean, it's having a really big impact. And those communities have said, could you help us look at this and see if you can do something about that? And I think that it's not just it's not so narrowly focused on us, on just us and what we do here anymore, but we do have people out there who are really affected, even particularly in our border communities. So with that being said, now that you're at the table, welcome. Welcome to the committee. Whichever one of you would like to start.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Kirshner, and I'm chair of the Juvenile Justice Information Task Force. And as chair, I'm also a member of the policy group. We are here today to provide a review for you of recommendations made by the policy group in the area of background checks and the sealing of criminal history records. About a year ago, you may remember that a task force committee prepared for you a fairly in-depth research, analysis, and report in the area of background checks and the sealing of criminal history records. The policy group since that time has taken a great deal of time to review all of that analysis and have developed for you some high-level recommendations in both of those areas. In addition, and possibly to answer some of Senator Ortman's earlier questions, rather than specifically recommend options, a number of options are provided for you in the back of the report, and there are fiscal implications attached to those various options for your review and consideration as you look in this area. I'm going to be reviewing for you some of the recommendations in the area of background checks, and then in a few minutes, Steve Holmgren, who's the first vice chair of the task force and also a member of the policy group, will be summarizing the area of sealing and expunging of criminal history records. A lot of this is contained in the report that you have before you, starting on page 6. But the policy group basically looked at developing and answering three specific questions in the area of background checks. The first question had to do with whether statutorily mandated background checks should be consistent in their approach. Currently, there are over 30 statutorily mandated background checks in Minnesota, and yet very few of them are consistent in either how they define what a background check is, what should be done with the background check, what systems those background checks should actually be allowed to access, and then what the results would be. The second question the policy group looked at answering was, should statutorily mandated background checks adopt consistent procedures related to protecting the subject of the background check and how they should be notified and what information should be provided to them? And then finally, the policy group looked at answering whether or not background checks conducted by state agencies could or should be done at no charge for citizens who are actually volunteering to provide a service to their community. Currently, while the state is authorized to charge for those fees, there is no authorization to allow those fees to be waived in the area of volunteers. So in looking at answering those three questions, three specific recommendations were developed. Now, again, these are very high-level or conceptual recommendations, and a lot of the options or fiscal implications of implementing these recommendations are available for you in the back of the report. The first recommendation that the policy group makes to you is that background checks should indeed be more consistent, and they should be guided by six specific principles. First of all, if you're going to have a statutorily mandated background check, they should be developed and implemented similarly for similar occupations. So right now there's a wide variety of definition, but in similar occupations and in similar license types, those background checks should be defined and implemented consistently. Secondly, when there are situations where there's potential risk to the public or vulnerable populations, there should be specific systems and data allowed to influence how that information is sought in a background check. It should be consistent, and it should be determined by the level of risk either to the public or to those sets of vulnerable populations. Thirdly, if the background check is going against a fingerprint-based system, then fingerprints should be used to go against that system. As was mentioned in the earlier report by Judge Gomez, sometimes if you're using similar names, it may be easy to not realize you're getting a record of someone with a similar name. So if the system that you're going against is actually fingerprint or biometrically based, then you should be using that fingerprint to get the information from that system. The fourth area is that as a long-term goal, the state of Minnesota should pursue national background information specifically from the FBI. As you all know, especially in our century, we have a very mobile population. We can't be naive enough to assume that everything we need to know in a particularly vulnerable area is contained in Minnesota alone. So as a long-term goal, we should be looking at trying to access that information from beyond Minnesota's boundaries. The fifth area is that in particular where there are potential risks to children, a specifically vulnerable population, we should have those background checks as mandatory rather than as optional. In some of the areas today, a background check is authorized, but it's not made as mandatory. It's simply said, if you want to do one in these areas, you can. And finally, related to this recommendation, some of the older arrest information and suspense information, which, as you may know, suspense information is that information which has not yet been verified by any kind of a biometric or specific identification information that can be tied to the record, that should be provided only to public agencies doing background checks and not to the number of other areas doing them. The second recommendation that the policy group would like to provide to you is that there should indeed be more consistent procedures and safeguards to protect and provide information to the subject of the background check. In the first area, there should be consistent information provided to an individual that indeed a background check is being done on them. It should provide consistent information on who's doing the background check, how far back the background check is going, whether or not the background check is going to include automatic updates, and that kind of thing, so that the subject of the record or the subject of the background check knows exactly what's happening and how far back that history is going. Secondly, related to that recommendation, if indeed it's identified in statute any kind of disqualifying offenses, the subject of the record should be notified that those are indeed disqualifying offenses. The subject of the record, thirdly, should be provided with a copy of the background check. Often an individual may know that one's being done, but they don't know what the result is or what it looks like. And then that leads to the fourth area, which the subject of the record should be provided with their rights to see the background check and then what process they can use to make corrections if there should be any inaccuracies. Next, a notice should be provided in this recommendation to the subject of the background check of the background check has been completed and who they can contact if there are any questions. And finally, as a protection for the subject of the background check, when that background check is completed, it can be only used for that purpose. Now that you have that information, the user of the background check couldn't hold on to that to use it for a totally different purpose that the subject was not aware of. The third and final recommendation in the area of background checks that the policy group would like to offer for you is that background checks conducted by state agencies for volunteers should be done at either no cost or reduced cost, and again, depending on either the fiscal implications that you all consider. At this point, volunteers are individuals who are literally volunteering for the public benefit. And if their background check is not reimbursed by some of the sources that are available, the policy group felt it important to allow that check to be done either at reduced cost or at no cost to the volunteer themselves, to encourage that public good that comes out of their volunteer efforts. Those were the three recommendations that the policy group made related to background checks, and I will now turn it over to Mr. Holmgren related to the area of sealing and expunging of criminal records.
Mr. Holmgren, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. As Ms. Kirshner mentioned, I am the first vice chair of the State of Minnesota Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force, and by reason of my position there, I'm also a member of the policy group, so I've been actively involved for the last several years on the expungement background check issue. My purpose today is to give you an overview of the expungement portion of the recommendations. I regret that they are somewhat technical, so I'll have to delve into some of the detail. Before I do that, I'd really like to just back up and sort of convey the approach or the perspective that the policy group took to this problem. As we began to study the report of the delivery team, and it quickly became apparent that the information world is significantly different today than it was just a few years ago. Technology has changed, and the advent of the Internet and the popularity of the Internet has significantly changed the availability and access to criminal records. A few years ago, you had to go down to the courthouse or physically go down to the BCA or hire somebody to go out and do a background check. Today, you don't have to do that. You can do that via the Internet from home or for your business. Mm-hmm. And obviously, what this does is not just allow employers and landlords to do records checks, but also casual checks can be done by people of their neighbors or families, that type of thing. The policy group took the approach that our major concern here was with the collateral consequences to criminal convictions. And I couldn't help but think as I listened to Judge Gomez that this is really the perfect segue to our report, because she did an outstanding job, and her committee did, of explaining the need, I think, for expungement law reform. The concept of paying your debt to society has really been blurred recently, because even though you can serve out your criminal sentence, pay, you know, serve your jail, pay your fine, make restitution, there still are the collateral consequences that are much more difficult to overcome and much more difficult to recover from and ultimately interfere with your ability to become a productive, law-abiding citizen as you try to reenter or reintegrate into society. So the policy group took this approach and believes that expungement reform is necessary, but what we also tried to do is do it in such a manner, make recommendations in such a manner that also protected the public. We realized it was a balancing approach. On the one hand, we want to try to give people relief from collateral consequences through this mechanism, but also wanted to protect the public in the sense that the public needs access to some of this information to protect the public. So what we did is we developed these high-level policy recommendations, and we essentially phrased them in terms of three or four global questions or issues. The first issue that we addressed is on page 10 of the report, was trying to address the issue of what use should expunged records be available for. Perhaps I should say this. Ultimately, what we're recommending is for expanded use of or expanded eligibility for expungement. But we want to do that so that the public safety is protected, as I said. And this is a way, our recommendations are such that we're trying to protect the public. The first one is we believe that expunged records should still be available for criminal justice purposes without a court order. Present law requires the police, for example, to get to be able to access an expunged record, they need to go into court and make a showing that it's necessary and convince a judge that this is an appropriate record, or they have an appropriate legal to look at this. Our recommendation is that this should automatically be available for various criminal justice-related purposes. And we're not trying to hide this record from criminal justice system. Basically, what we're trying to do is address collateral consequences, and we think that by recommending this, we address public safety. Similarly, we're recommending that sealed convictions also be available for certain other purposes. For example, if someone's applying for a gun permit, public safety requires people to know what prior convictions these folks had. Predatory offender registration is another example. Someone should not be allowed to defeat the purposes of predatory offender registration by an expungement. Thirdly, we're recommending that expunged convictions be available for certain statutorily mandated background checks. We recognize that there are very many professions out there or other reasons that the legislature has deemed it appropriate for a background check to be conducted, and we think that these should be available for background checks that the legislature deems it appropriate for. Our recommendation, however, is that it should only apply when an agency has some sort of review process so that a person who is subject to these background checks has the ability to challenge any type of background check or disqualification. They need to be aware of what is being said or about them because of the fact that Judge Gomez and Ms. Kirshner alluded to right now. We haven't gotten to the point yet where all of our records are necessarily linked biometrically to individuals. The second general policy issue that we addressed is the issue of whether or not sealing should be uniform across government agencies. This generally, we refer to it as the state versus Schultz problem. The situation is such in current law that there are two ways, essentially, to go about trying to get an expungement. One is through the statute, which allows expungement in some limited situations, generally non-convictions. There are a few exceptions to that. But there's also a second way to apply for an expungement, and petition the court through their inherent authority. They have the ability in the interests of justice to be able to grant expungements. The problem is the court's authority is only applicable to their own records. And although there was a recent case just this week that has opened up some question about this, it, at least prior to this case, the court was only able to seal records, their own records. Essentially, the executive branch would not have to follow an expungement order. On the other hand, the statutory expungements do, in fact, apply across the board to all agencies.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, there's another issue, but about that court of appeals decision. The Court of Appeals said that even where there's an inherent authority decision, now the BCA and executive branches must seal records following a court order. Is that a fair interpretation of that decision?
Mr. Holmgren.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I read that case the other day, and there's still some question in my mind about how that applies. I think in my reading, and this is just my one lawyer's reading, it appears to me that certainly the court's documents, if they're in the hands of another agency, could be sealed. The question in my mind is still whether or not information gleaned from that court document would necessarily need to be sealed. In other words, if the BCA, I don't know how they enter them, but I assume someone types them into their database, whether that record is still subject to sealing. And that's the question I have from reading the case. I didn't see where there was a definite answer, but of course lawyers can differ.
Senator Ortman and Senator Betzel.
So what you're saying is if there's, say, a database with names and information that's separate from the record itself, the record might have to be sealed, but not necessarily the information that's existing in some other database?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's my concern with the reading. It's also a Court of Appeals case, and I don't know that the Supreme Court has yet ruled on that. So,
follow-up, Senator Ullman.
The second issue that I had with it is not just that the executive branch is not necessarily sealing what the court thinks that or is ordering to be sealed. The other thing is that if the court is acting on inherent authority basis and not on the statutory basis, then we haven't, as a legislature, suggested to them the factors to consider, the process, the issues of public safety that maybe we might want to put into a statute. And that's as much a concern for me. What is the standard for an inherent authority expungement? I'm not really sure. And I'm not really sure that I feel comfortable with it being a matter of common law. And so I think there are two really big issues with the inherent authority decisions by the court.
Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, of course, we spent quite a bit of time looking at the expungement issue last year, but it's now my understanding that there's one case that the Minnesota Supreme Court has granted certiorari on that they're going to look at. The other one that Mr. Holmgren just alluded to, I imagine, could very well go to the Supreme Court as well, too. And so it could very well be that we may have to hold back on any legislative action until we let these cases run their course and then see what our response is in the legislative arena. So, I think we've got some hot issues on expungement just as recently as this week that we have to be sensitive to.
Well, certainly, last year when we were engaging in this discussion, the only case that we were staring at was the Schultz case. And so these new developments certainly presents an interesting turn in this conversation. And I agree, Senator Betzel, that it would be interesting to see what the Supremes ultimately or might want to tell us about where these two decisions are. It would be interesting. To see whether or not they do take up the Court of Appeals decision. Mr. Holmgren, please continue.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you. The next area, the third area, is on that we took up and actually made a recommendation for. It's on page 12. And that involves the issue of whether or not this statute should be expanded to create more eligibility for expungement. And the short answer is that the policy group is, in fact, recommending yes. Expungement should now be available to other to conviction-type offenses, but with several procedural safeguards. Generally speaking, what we're recommending are a series of waiting periods prior to someone being able to petition for expungement. You can see in the bottom, near the bottom of page 12, there is a chart there which basically categorizes crimes and gives periods of time that are waiting periods that are suggested. Now, I want everyone to understand that these are arbitrary numbers. We had asked the Department of Administration folks to see if they could find some sort of research-based criteria on which to establish some numbers on, and they were unable to find some. Essentially, these numbers came out of a discussion we had a year or more ago at a delivery team meeting, and we just threw them out as a possible framework. So it's just important for everybody to understand that they're arbitrary at this point. They're what we suggest, but if there was some better method of determining these types of waiting periods, certainly the policy group would be in support of that. The second factor that we're basing expanded eligibility on is that a person needs to maintain good behavior to be eligible for an expungement. The recommendation is that the period, the clock starts over, is the phrase we've been using. But basically, the time period for waiting for an expungement and for allowing yourself to be rehabilitated starts over if you have a new violation of the law. An additional factor is that some types of offenses should not be eligible for expungement. If you're required to register for predatory offender registration, you certainly should not be able to expunge away that obligation. Similarly, the view is that traffic offenses should not necessarily be subject to expungement procedures because the Department of Public Safety driver folks have some sort of aging type practice now where they certain criminal or traffic records tend to fall off of your record as time passes by. And it's our thought that it's probably more work than it's worth to try to get these things from the court perspective to try to expunge these non-traffic or these traffic offenses, excuse me. Next, you should not be on probation or under some sort of correctional supervision at the time you apply for an expungement. If you're in a diversion program, you should be expected to complete that. Or if you have a pending charge, you should also not be eligible for expungement remedy, your recommendation. We're recommending that expungement remedy be applied to juvenile cases that are public. We think that the law allowed this at this point, but we wanted to clarify that juvenile convictions that are public should have the expungement or process available to them. We also created a list of factors that we recommend the court consider when considering an expungement. This is what I believe Senator Ortman was referring to on bottom of page 13. We have basically taking a bunch of ideas, and I quite frankly, I think a lot of these were Senator Ortman's because I remember we were looking at various bills when we did this and tried to pick the best of ideas we could as to what the court should consider because we, like many people, were concerned that there needed to be some guidelines to the court if, in fact, we were going to open up expungements to convictions. The fourth and final area of our recommendation.
Mr. Holmgren, Senator Olson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Holmgren, I'm just wondering about the recommendation on page 13 when you say that convictions for certain crimes on the top of the page are ineligible to petition. And I understand the registration crimes, but then you have traffic offenses. And I guess I'm just wondering why would you treat them more seriously in terms of expungement than, say, a felony?
Mr. Holmgren.
I can tell you I've personally had some difficulty with this issue, too. But the way this issue came about was many of the folks on the delivery team felt that there was needed to be some sort of limitation on traffic offenses, that generally they're not seen as being as serious. We didn't think the collateral consequences as far as employment, those type of things, may be as serious. And ultimately, the majority of the folks on our delivery team agreed with that, and that became the recommendation. The policy group, I think, and it's hard for me to speak in general or to speak for everyone there, felt that oftentimes if you opened up the door to expungements for everything, that the courts would be severely burdened by expungement petitions. So it's something that I think that's the best answer I can come up with. I'm not sure if anyone else on our team has a better answer, perhaps. Ms. Engler reminded me that I was correct initially that drivers, DVS actually drops most of these off of your traffic record automatically. I don't recall specifically what the time period is, but I do know for a fact, at least when I was actively practicing traffic-type law, that many convictions, traffic convictions, would fall off the record after a period of time. DWIs and convictions like that do not, however, because of the fact that the enhancement periods are so much longer, but generic speeding ticket, those type of things now fall away.
And Senator Olson, I think that, you know, your question goes to the point that I was trying to make earlier when Ms. Kirshner and Mr. Holmgren were coming to the table, that, you know, that might be one area that we want to take a look at with respect to the, you know, nowadays our computer background check systems doesn't just connect all of us in the United States or within Minnesota. I mean, we are collaborating as a result of heightened security around our borders. We're actively collaborating with our border neighbors. And so our records and information are easily accessible and shared among law enforcement, you know, for example, in Canada. And so now there's a different lens suddenly on all the work that we're doing from that perspective. And so I am not sure if that was even calculated or part of the conversation in the policy group or the delivery team, but it certainly was very eye-opening for me last week to have those conversations, that what we do with respect to traffic offenses, which we considered, you know, I mean, it's a big deal in terms of the DWIs, but in terms of the actual sentences or the conviction, that in another country, it is a really big deal, and it could have a life-changing impact on people's ability to do their jobs. So certainly these recommendations are good for us to think about, but it also creates an opportunity for us to look at other areas. So Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, one of the current concerns that I had was that if we're going to turn this issue over to the judges and give them discretion and have a hearing and an expungement hearing, they're going to be considering all these factors. If we then take certain crimes out of their purview, now we've limited their discretion, and if the whole theory was we're going to trust them with this, should we be telling them which crimes we're going to say we can't trust them with? And if we do that, then every year when we come back and there's been another crime that's been identified and sensationalized in the media, are we all going to come back and say, now, judge, we can't consider these for expungement anymore? And so I think in my thinking, it might be better to just say the judges can handle this. Maybe there are some that we, you know, clearly don't like. But I think when we start engaging in that, we are then taking away the very discretion that I think they need when they see these people and deal with this on a case-by-case basis, to say this person is rehabilitated and the public safety is not jeopardized by allowing this person to have an expungement. So I think it's a fine line. I mean, you can come down either way on it, you know, concern out of public safety. And it's, I think, maybe the heart of this issue is, can we trust the judges with this much discretion or not?
And we'll have plenty of time to talk about that. Mr. Holmgren, please continue.
Madam Chair, Senators, the final area of recommendation is regarding what we are calling automatic expungements. It's the belief of the policy group that in some limited circumstances, expungement should be granted just automatically, maybe by passage of time. Specifically, we're recommending that when proceedings were resolved in favor of the petitioner, under the circumstances, for example, where you were arrested but not charged, or where you were charged but the case was dismissed, that those situations, there should be an automatic expungement. The recommendation is that there be a one-year waiting period because of the amount of time that it takes sometimes for the criminal process to generate a case, for investigation to be conducted, that type of thing.
Mr. Holmgren, Senator Higgins has a question on that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Holmgren, did you folks discuss, let me give some background first. When people are renting houses that go through the foreclosure proceeding, most of them at the end of the redemption period will get an unlawful detainer and told they have to leave. And it's on the record for like for flipping forever, and it's something they had nothing to do with. You know, they weren't the person not paying the bills; they were just renting. And I wondered whether the policy group had a discussion about those folks, because if we do anything in here, that's one group that it ought to be an automatic expungement without the one-year waiting list, because they're a victim of circumstances, and they did nothing wrong.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Holmgren.
Senator Higgins. We did not consider anything outside of the criminal arena.
Well,
so we looked
specifically
at criminal convictions and charges and arrests.
Okay. Sorry.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Holmgren. With the testimony we've heard about other avenues of data mining and what's out there in the private sector, if the government is expunging these records, is the cost involved in doing that? Do you accomplish anything if this information is so available elsewhere? Or did you talk about that issue?
Mr. Holmgren.
Madam Chair, Senator, we did in fact talk about that issue. And, in fact, the policy group has authorized or has directed the task force now to study that issue, because we realize certainly that something needs to be done to control, I think, the records when they are outside of government, outside of the hands of government. So we are convening a delivery team, I think this month is when we start.
This meeting is next week.
To look into this issue. It's certainly an issue that we realize is important. It's critical to having a workable solution to cover this. On a similar line, we, as Judge Gomez mentioned, we don't view expungements necessarily as being the solution. There needs to be a multifaceted approach. We weren't able to study certificates of rehabilitation, for example, just because of time. But we realized that that is another arrow in the quiver, which is a phrase that was said earlier, that the policy group would support. We need to take sort of a multifaceted approach, and certainly the whole data harvesting issue is one that needs to be addressed.
Please continue.
The recommendation, just to be clear, about the arrests that weren't charged or the cases that were charged were dismissed, the recommendation is that these automatic expungements only apply to arrests or charges that were not that did not allege a crime of violence against the person. It was felt that people who are charged with crimes of violence still should be able to seek expungement, but would have to file a petition. The automatic expungement provisions are, to make it clear, I think, are expungements where there's no need to file an petition. It just happens with the passage of time. Similarly, those people who received a continuance for dismissal in court, a stay of adjudication in court, or successfully completed a diversion program should also be eligible for an automatic expungement, provided that the prosecutor agreed to the continuance, stay, or diversion, which is usually the case, and that the subject of the continuance, stay of adjudication, or diversion satisfactorily completed the conditions. In those situations, those folks should also be entitled to an automatic expungement, because really what's trying to be done here is we're trying to do what lawyers and judges have been telling defendants for years, that if you do this, this will be kept off of your record. Well, we know in reality now that it's really not kept off their record. So really we're just trying to facilitate the will and the intent of the parties in the courtroom. So we recommend that in those situations that those expungements also be automatic. With that, that pretty much is a summary of our recommendations.
Well, thank you, Ms. Kirshner and Ms. Holmgren. And I also know that Ms. Engler, Mr. Dave Anderson, who is our new Dale Good, is here. He is the CRIMNET, from the CRIMNET program office. Actually, Dave Johnson is the new executive director of CRIMNET. Mr. David Anderson is the CRIMNET program from the CRIMNET program office, and then Ms. Dana Goetz is also. They're also all here to help us answer questions on the report. They've all worked very hard to do this. I personally have to express my appreciation for the CRIMNET program office for taking on this task. We asked them to do some of this work a couple of years ago. The recommendations came back last year, and even though in the 2007 session we didn't fund them, they felt that this was good policy work to continue to do without a carrot, or in this case an added incentive from the legislature. And I think that for that, the recommendations will be very useful and helpful for us. I'm glad to hear that you are convening a working group to look at the data piece. I have put together a bill, and now I'm going to think about whether or not I want that jacket and introduce. Perhaps, you know, I'm interested in continuing to have that conversation with you on the data piece of it. In addition to Senator Betzel's data harvester bill, but there's a larger discussion about data mining that I hope your working group could illuminate for us. Any questions for the delivery teams, all the different task force, and all the individuals who participated to give us this, we owe you our thanks, and thank you for all your hard work. Any questions to Ms. Kirshner, Mr. Holmgren, or any of the members? Very good. Thank you very much. And members, again, let me just remind you, on Tuesday and Thursday, we'll meet in the afternoon and in the evening. For those of you who weren't here at the beginning, we will start our evening meeting at 6:30, and hopefully we'll finish by 8:30. I know, Senator Ortman, but we either do that now or we have 3, 4, 5 meetings. And I did warn the members that I saved you not having – all of us not having to come in on Friday, and I'm trying to stay away from, you know, the Fridays. Not guaranteed. We might end up having to do that, but there's a lot of work to do in this very short session, so I appreciate all of you. Huh? We might. We're trying to move things around with the double booking to see what we can accommodate. So thank you all very much. Thank you, everyone, for coming and for all the great work that you've done. We're adjourned.
Yes, I think so.